You know, Virginia thanks me every single day for saving her life. And I tell her, you got it all wrong. If she wouldn't have insisted I get into that ambulance, I would have been standing at the base of that building when it came down, and I'd be dead. No doubt in my mind. But she insisted that I get into that ambulance. And that's why I'm here today to tell you my story.
Hi, I'm Naomi Murphy, and this is the Locked Up Living podcast, where we talk with a wide range of people about harsh aspects of institutional life.
We also explore some of the ways to overcome them and to grow and develop. I'm David Jones.
So join us every Wednesday morning, 6 o'clock UK time, for a fresh podcast.
Hi, today's guest is Ari Shonbrun, who's an author, speaker and 9/11 survivor. He was the Chief Administrative Officer of Cantor Fitzgerald & Co., one of the world's leading financial services firms, and was working on the 78th floor of Tower 1 when the first plane hit on September the 11th, 2001. He helped a colleague suffering third-degree burns to safety and was thrown into the national spotlight thereafter. His miraculous first-hand account about survival has been retold in newspapers, magazines, broadcast outlets and books. Mr. Shonbrun is a renowned inspirational speaker and the author of Miracles and Fate on 78. He draws from the personal heartbreak he endured during the devastation of 9/11 and has inspired audiences worldwide. He's also the host of Whispers and Bricks podcast and the creator of Whispers and Bricks Academy, which is a seven-week programme focusing on your personal breakthrough. Mr. Shonbrun is a native New Yorker. He's passionate about philanthropy and serves as a board member of Strength to Strength, a global non-profit organisation that works with victims of terror across the world. Mr. Shonbrun and his wife Joyce live in New York and have five children and several grandchildren. We're really delighted to be able to have you on the show today to talk about your experiences, Ari. Welcome.
Thank you so much. So happy to be here.
Hi, Ari. Really great to meet with you. So, Ari, prior to 9/11, had you done much public speaking or played much of a role in supporting people in their personal development? Or was this something you felt you had a kind of natural talent for?
Well, I was president of my synagogue for a while. And so I had to deliver, you know, talks and the like, but I never viewed myself as like a quote unquote motivational or inspirational speaker. So, you know, prior to 9/11, I really didn't do much. I also didn't do much coaching, so to speak, but people always, for whatever reason, tended to come to me to ask for, you know, advice or, you know, I always found myself helping people, whether it was, somebody looking for a job or, you know, somebody having issues. For whatever reason, people turned to me, they trusted me. And, you know, I would talk to, you know, I would basically help anybody that came to ask. So, unofficially, I guess, you know, I was in the helping people mode.
Yeah, you were that kind of guy. Yeah, I can well understand that. So can you tell us something about your experience on 9/11 and what it was like for you?
Whoa. Okay, loaded question. So I was working for Cantor Fitzgerald at the time. We occupied the top five floors of Tower 1. The North Tower of the World Trade Center. And we employed 960 people. On that day, 658 of my friends and coworkers lost their lives. I mean, they were basically murdered simply because they were sitting at the desks. I mean, you know, they came to work and they did what they did every day. And on that day, they just didn't come home. Four employees were actually on the upper floors on their way up to the offices. And three of them were so severely burned, they spent months and months in hospitals undergoing surgeries and rehabilitations. And one of them walked out without a scratch, and that was me. So it was a harrowing experience. It was about 20 to 7 in the morning on that day. And I had my briefcase over my shoulder, I had my cup of coffee in my hands. And I yelled up to my wife, bye, hon, love you, see ya. I yelled up to my kids, bye, kids, have a great day in school. And I started to walk out the door. All of a sudden, my wife yells down to me and she says, did you do Baruch's book order? Now, Baruch is my third child. He was 8 years old at the time. And I learned something that day. Teachers have a wonderful way of torturing parents. It's called the Scholastic Book Order. I don't know if you have that in the UK. I think you do. But it's basically a program whereby the teacher hands out these pamphlets that have a list of books and games on them. And the children are supposed to go home and choose, you know, some books. It's to help them with, you know, with their reading. My son was no different than any other 8 year old. We wanted like every book and every game in the pamphlet. And my wife, who is a school principal and just opened up school, had no patience for him. So she said to me, it was my job to do it. And I said, okay, no problem. I'll do it. Of course, I was working very, very long hours at that time because that was that year. It was 1 week before the Jewish holidays, the High Holy Days. And I knew that I was going to be out of the office for periods of time during the course of the following month. And so I was getting to the office very early and coming home very late. So I didn't have a chance to do it with him. She said, did you do the book order? And I said, no. She goes, you're not leaving this house until you do that book order. So I put my briefcase down, put my cup of coffee down, went into my kitchen, proceeded to negotiate with my 8 year old for the next 20 minutes. I whittled him down to two books, which I thought was pretty good. But interestingly enough, the two books were from a series called Survivor. When those books showed up a couple of weeks later, man, it was shivers down my spine. Unbelievable. It was prophetic, really. Oh, by the way, the book order was actually due on Monday, but my son left his pamphlet in school on Friday, and my wife wrote a note to the teacher asking if he could have an extra day, and she said sure, and she made sure to put the pamphlet in his knapsack, and he would bring it home. Had my son brought that pamphlet home on Friday, I would have done it with him on Sunday, and on Tuesday at 8 a.m., I would have been sitting at my desk. And right now you'd be talking to somebody else because I'd be dead. But because he left his pamphlet in school on Friday, I am here today to tell you a story. And you'll see that throughout my story, that's been a common thread. You know, the coincidences that happened throughout the course of the day, which all led me to avoid getting killed on that day. I got to the trade center about 20 minutes to nine, which was about 40 minutes later than normal. And you couldn't take an elevator up to the 101st floor. That's where my office was. But you took an elevator to 78, which was a sky lobby. And then from there, you changed to take another elevator to get up to the 101st floor. Well, I got into the elevator that came down. And when I got off on the 78th floor, the elevator I needed for my office was all the way on the left side of the sky lobby, the 78th floor sky lobby. So I proceeded to head down towards that elevator, and I must have been about 2 meters from that elevator when, as best as I can describe, there was an explosion. I thought a bomb had gone off in the elevator. The lights went out, the place filled with smoke, and I was literally thrown off my feet. And there was yelling and screaming and somebody yelling about fire in the elevator. And my thought process was, of course, there's fire in the elevator. A bomb just went off over there. You know, I had no idea. I finally see a light in between two banks of elevators that was an emergency light. So I figured it's probably a good place to go. But I remember as a kid, when there's a lot of smoke, what do? You stay low to the ground, right? I literally crawled from where I was to that light, to that, you know, hallway between the banks of elevators. And I got up and I'm looking around. I don't know where to go. You know, the only time I spend on that floor is just to switch elevators. So I walk behind the bank of elevators, and sure enough, there was a door there. It turns out there was a security office on that floor. I had no idea. I walk in there, and there was a guy who is the fire warden for the floor. And I run over to him. I said, what do we do? Where do we go? He goes, I don't know. I'm thinking to myself, of course he doesn't know. We didn't know what happened. All I knew was there was a bomb went off in the elevator. I ran outside, you know, back out into the hall to see if I can find a way out. And that's when I bumped into my coworker. Her name was Virginia DiChiara. Virginia was on the elevator that I was about to get on when that plane hit. And as she described it to me, she said, when the plane hit, the doors had started to close and they jammed open about you know, a foot, and the walls in the elevator collapsed. The ceiling collapsed. There was a cable that snapped, was sparking in the elevator. The jet fuel came down the sides of the elevator, was ignited by the sparks, and there was a wall of fire. There were three people in that elevator. There was Roy Bell, Virginia, and Renee. Roy was the first one to jump through the fire, and he suffered second-degree burns. Virginia jumped out right after he did, and she suffered third-degree burns. And Renee, who was the last one out, she died from her burns, all in a space of 6, 8, 10 seconds. That was the difference between life and death that day, at least for these three people. And she sees me, and she's a mess. She has third-degree burns up and down her arms. Her clothes are burnt. Her hair is singed. She was a total mess. And she says to me, Ari, thank God, please help me. Whatever you do, please don't leave me. And I said to Virginia, I promise I will not leave you, and we will get out of here. Now, here's a bit of irony. Virginia and I were not good friends. She was an internal auditor who had been hired the year before, and the first department she audited was mine. And needless to say, she didn't give me very good marks. As a matter of fact, she almost got me fired. And there we were. And I had a decision to make. You know, I mean, things are bad, and she was a mess. And I said, you know what? Our past did not matter. She was another human being. She was in trouble. I was the guy that God put there. All right. And I made my decision, and I said, I don't care. Virginia, I will do whatever it takes, and we will get out of here. I brought her into that office, gave her to drink. And finally, the fire warden says, okay, we can get out. Stairwell on the left. We head out. I go around a bend, and there's a door there. We open the door, and sure enough, there's the stairwell. Now, interestingly enough, you know, most of the stairwells in the Trade Center went down 10, 20, maybe 30 flights of stairs, and that was it. And then you have to get out and find another stairwell. This one went from 78 all the way down to 1. How did this guy know? I have no idea, because the landlines were out. They were blown out when the plane went in, and the mobiles weren't working. So I have no idea how he knew, but whatever. So when I saw inside there were lights on, I thought to myself, they're probably emergency lights, and I don't know how long they're going to last. So it was Roy Bell, myself, the fire warden, Virginia, and there must have been about 6 or 8 other people with us from the floor. And I turned around, and I said to the people behind me, I said, does anybody have a flashlight? Thinking to myself, if the lights go out in the stairwell, it'll be pitch black. And two people actually, you know, raised their hands and were like, yeah, we got flashlights. And I'll never forget, I was thinking to myself, where did you get a flashlight from, and why are you carrying it? You know, but I said, listen, folks, nobody panic. If the lights go out, we will have light. The next thing I did was I looked down at Virginia's feet, and I said, thank God she's wearing flats. Because you know what? There were high-heeled shoes in that stairwell all the way down. Women had just kicked them off to get down as fast as they could. So we started to head down. It was the fire warden, Roy Bell, myself, and Virginia. We walked in a line. I remember that because I remember telling Virginia, listen, if you feel faint, if you feel like you're going to fall forward, fall on me, and I'll carry you. And we started to head down. We got down 3 flights of stairs when one of the biggest miracles of the day happened to me, other than the fact that I wasn't killed when the plane hit, my mobile rang. Now, most people look at me and they go like, yes, so what? Well, you know what? In the Trade Center, you could never, ever get reception. You just couldn't. I remember standing in my office by the window going, hello, can you hear me now? Can you hear me now? Couldn't get reception. And here I was in the middle of a stairwell, in the middle of the building on a day where there was no reception, and my phone rang. I picked it up. I went, hello? It was my wife on the other end of that phone. And she was crying, and she was telling me something about a plane going into the building. I had no idea what she was talking about. I said to her, Joyce, I'm in a stairwell. I'm on the 75th floor. I'm on my way down. Now is not a good time. I said, I'll call you when I get out of the building. And I hung up the phone, not realizing, of course, it would be hours until I spoke to her again. We went down. We got down to about the 50th floor. And Virginia goes, Ari, I can't go on, can't do it. And I said, no, Virginia, you can do this. I mean, I thought first, you know, maybe I'll have her sit down and rest a little bit, and then we'll get up and keep moving. And then I thought to myself, if she sits down, she may never get up. And if she doesn't get up, she's going to die. There was no doubt in my mind. And I said, no, not on my watch. And I went, Virginia, you can do this. And we gave her, some people had some bottles of water. We poured it on her arms to give her, you know, relief from the burns. We gave her to drink. And I'm counting the floors down, you know, 45, 44, 42. 40, you're doing great. You're doing great. And we were doing great until 38. 38 was backed up with people. The firefighters coming up had stopped the people from going down. So I'm getting really scared because she needs help. And so I turned to the people in the hallway and I went like, is there a paramedic in the building? I have a burn victim here. We need help. If you're a paramedic, please help us. And if not, please step to the right and let us through. And they did. People squeezed over as much as possible just to let us go down. We got down to, the first floor. And the fire warden is still leading. I says, where are you going? He goes, we have to get out through the garage. So I turned to Virginia. I said, you know, we just came down 78 flights of stairs. What's another four or five? And we continued down. We got down two flights when all of a sudden the door on the first floor opens up and some guy yells out, where are you people going? I said, we're going out through the garage. He goes, no, you can't come out. You can't go out through the garage. You have to come back up here and come out through the first floor. I turned to Virginia. I said, we got to go back up two flights. Well, she said a few things that I can't say in mixed company or in any company. And we headed back up. Here's the thing. I found out later there were people in that garage that never got out. Who is the guy who opened the door? I don't know. I never saw him. All I heard was a voice. And why did he pick that moment to open the door? I don't know. But that guy saved our lives that day. So we get out on the first floor. We go out through the mall, through the atrium. We finally get out of the building. And I ask a cop, I said, I have a burn victim. Where should we go? He says, in front of the Millennium Hotel. We're setting up a triage center. Go there. We went there. Sure enough, an ambulance pulls up. I help Virginia into the ambulance. I breathe a sigh of relief because at least now she's getting medical attention, something I couldn't give her. They wouldn't leave until they filled the ambulance because they were expecting a huge amount of casualties. They finally fill the ambulance. And I'm breathing a sigh of relief. And Virginia says to me, Ari, you're coming with us. Now, I didn't really want to go anywhere at that point, because as soon as that ambulance leaves, I'm going back to the building to look for my friends and coworkers and to help. I said, Virginia, you don't need me anymore. She turns to the ambulance driver and she says, we're not leaving unless he comes with us. I look at the ambulance driver. He looks at me. He's thinking, this is not a cab service. I'm thinking, I don't need a cab. Anyway, I said, you know what? Maybe for our own psychological well-being, maybe I should come. He says, fine, hop into the front. And I got into the front of that ambulance and we pulled away. We were one of only a few ambulances that actually got away from the scene that day. You know, Virginia thanks me every single day for saving her life. And I tell her, you got it all wrong. If she wouldn't have insisted I get into that ambulance, I would have been standing at the base of that building when it came down and I'd be dead. No doubt in my mind. But she insisted that I get into that ambulance. And that's why I'm here today to tell you my story.
That's a very, very powerful account, Ari. Thank you very much for that. I mean, it was such a terrible event. It gouged a scar, a physical scar across New York and an emotional scar across the world, really, because we all remember that day, I'm sure, very clearly. I know precisely what I was doing on that day. But I don't talk about it very often. This is one of the few times that I've been in a conversation about that day, actually. And it's very affecting, even still. So we know that thousands of people lost their lives that day, and we read that about 11% of New Yorkers had post-traumatic stress disorder afterwards, with the rates higher the further south you went below Canal Street. Mm-hmm. How were you affected by that at all, do you think?
So up until probably a year ago, I would say I was not affected by it. I didn't suffer from survivor's guilt. I was very happy that I survived. I didn't really suffer from PTSD, but about a year ago, all of a sudden, loud noises drove me crazy. I was very, very frightened every time I heard a loud noise. And, you know, I started to like, you know, it drove me crazy. And a friend of mine said to me, of course you have PTSD. That's your problem. I'm going like, no, I don't. And he goes, because, you know, who wants to admit that, you know? But he says, yeah, those are the classic symptoms that you have. You have PTSD. So yeah, I would say I didn't, but I think I did, you know, about a year ago, all of a sudden, it hit me. And it could have been because of the, you know, 20th anniversary, you know, that was coming up. It could be because of that. I don't know. But I mean, I think I'm okay.
Yeah, but it was clearly a transformational experience for you. It couldn't have been anything other than that. So how did it affect you and your family life, your social life? Well, particularly during that, or what you're describing really is almost 20 years.
Right. So it had a profound effect on me and my family. But it's funny because it was in stages. All right. And I would say like first stage was paranoia, whereby I would, you know, before I left my house in the morning to go to work, I would literally open my front door, stick my head out, look up and down my street and see if anybody was there, you know, because I was, you know, maybe they're out to get me. Maybe they're, you know, it was tremendous paranoia. On the other side of the coin, I became much, much closer with my children and with my wife. You know, I mean, it was a near-death experience, and, you know, it was, and my life as a whole changed. Now, it didn't happen right away. All right. Like I tell people, I was the same guy on Wednesday that I was on Tuesday, only I lost 658 friends and coworkers, but I was still the same guy. And as I started to tell my story, it started to sink in, you know, what had really happened to me and the miracles that happened throughout the course of the day. And I went like, wow, God literally plucked me out of a collapsing, burning building and gave me a second chance. And it was like, it was like a dare, you know what I'm saying? God's like, okay, I'm giving you a second chance. What are you going to do with it? You know, and I took it to heart and I went, you know what? My life is going to change. I wasn't put here just to make money. Okay. That's not why I was put on this earth. And I kind of realized that, you know, one of my missions was to try and make the world a better place. And the way to do that is just to talk to people about my experience and let them know that, you know, there's a reason why we're here. Everybody has it, you know, everybody has their own reason why they're there or why they're put into certain situations. I mean, I was put into a situation to give a test that what would I do with Virginia? Would I save her or not save her? All right. I think I passed that test. All right. And then as time went on, the change in me started to happen, but very slowly. And it took about 8 or 9 months until that change fully happened. And I tell people the reason it stuck, it's 20 plus years later, and I still am that new person. All right. When 9/11 happened, like New York City became a whole different city. Everybody was all for one and one for all. How can I help? And it lasted about 6 months. And then New York City went right back to what it was before. All right. With me, it took about 8 months until it sunk in. And that's why it stuck. It wasn't like on Tuesday night or Wednesday, I was like, all right, I'm going to become a monk and I'm going to sit on a, you know, go up onto a mountain and meditate. It's not what happened. Okay. It was just slowly. And I started to change myself. One of the biggest changes that I made was I promised myself that I wasn't going to swear anymore. I wasn't going to use any four letter words anymore. And here's the funny thing, because I made that decision, whenever there was a meeting going on, whether it was in my office or somebody else's office, if I was present at the meeting, nobody would swear. Nobody would swear because everybody knew Ari Shomer doesn't swear. And you got to remember something. I worked on Wall Street. right? These guys are worse than drunken sailors. I mean, they're it's horrible. But everybody knew Ari Shomer doesn't swear, and so nobody did. So because I made a decision, look at the effect that it had on the world around me.
Thank you, Ari. I mean, it's clear from listening to you that your spirituality has been really important to you even before 9/11, but you can hear that also in your account afterwards. Are there other aspects of who you are that you think contributed to, you know, rather than allowing this to shape your life in a way, rather than allow this to help, you know, for your life to spiral downwards, it sounds like you really took the growth out of the experience to try and change yourself and the world around you for the better. And I wonder what else was there besides spirituality, or do you think was that all driven from your faith?
It's not only spirituality, okay? Because I was the type of guy who would fly off the handle at the drop of a hat. I was a yeller, I was a screamer. And you know, it's just, you know, it's just, it was my nature. That's what I was. And after 9/11, I said to myself, you know what? I don't really like the guy I used to be. I almost lost my life. All right. I've given a second chance. I think I need to change. And I did. And my relationship with people got better. All right. So that was, you know, as much as, I mean, obviously the relationship with my kids, you know, because you used to be work was the most important part of my life. Okay. Everything for work. And my kids used to say to me, like, you know, daddy, can you come to the school play? I have the lead role. And I'd say, no, daddy's got to work. Daddy, can you come on a class trip? We're going to the zoo. No, daddy's got to work. You know, daddy, can you come to mock trial? That's after school. So that's after work. So you could be there, right? No, daddy's got to work late. That was always the refrain. Daddy's got to work. Daddy's got to work. Until that day. After that, it was daddy's at the class trips. Daddy's at the school plays. Daddy was ever wherever his children and now grandchildren need him to be, because that is what is important in life. So it wasn't only the spiritual. It was the physical as well, the physical world. And I treat people the way I want to be treated. Okay. I do. All right. You know, it's so funny how sometimes you have, you know, people that are, you know, they're so nice and they're, you know, they're jovial and they're, but you know, but when they walk into a restaurant, they'll yell and scream at the waiter. Like, what changed? You know, you were such a nice guy when we walked in here, and now all of a sudden you're yelling and screaming at the waiter. Well, who are you? You know, so, and I made sure to you know, that I wouldn't be guilty of doing something like that. So I treat everybody with respect. I don't care who you are. I don't care what you are. I don't care what your job is. Okay. Because whatever it is, all right, you're a human being and human beings deserve respect.
I'm curious about how you ended up deciding to start your podcast, Whispers and Bricks, and the associated Whispers and Bricks Academy, and wondering how much of that related to your experience that you'd had in this transformation to really try and do something that's enriching.
So before I started that, I was, you know, I was working on Wall Street. I only left Wall Street about 4.5 years ago. I started speaking about 6 weeks after 9/11 was the first time somebody asked me to tell my story. And from that point on, I was telling my story. So I was doing it part-time. I was doing it in my spare time, you know, sick days, vacation days, you know, whatever it was. And then 4.5 years ago, I decided that I wanted to leave Wall Street and I wanted to speak full time, which is what I did. And things were great. And then COVID hit. And when COVID hit, my whole speaking dried up because no more conferences, no more meetings, right? You know, so there was no more live events. So guess what? No more need for speakers. So I decided that, I was invited to be on a podcast by a friend of mine who I shared a stage with a few years ago. She was a victim of the Boston Marathon bombing and she lost her leg. And we were sharing a stage at this conference. And then she called me and we became good friends. And then she called me up about a year later asking me if I wanted to be on her podcast. And I went like, sure, I'll help you out. You know, I don't know. And after the podcast, she said to me, you know, you should have your own podcast because you have a great story. And I said, I don't know anything about podcasts. So she gives me the name of somebody to talk to. And the next thing you know, I've got a podcast. And it's Whispers and Bricks because, you know, the whispers represent, you know, the good things in life, what, you know, what God's whispering to our minds, he's whispering to our hearts. And the bricks are those bad things that happen when we're not listening to the whispers. We get hit with a brick, and everybody gets hit with a brick at some point in time. So that's kind of why I started the podcast, was to help people. Because I knew people, especially during COVID, were going through some really, really tough times. And I wanted people to understand, guess what? You're not the only one. We're all in this together. And I brought on people that have gone through experiences for better or worse, and that people should hear and know and get hope. So that's why I started the podcast. And after I started the podcast, you know, people were calling me about, oh, you know, can I get advice on this? Can I get advice on that? And that's when I realized, you know what, I should probably just start a coaching business, which I started the Whispers and Bricks Academy, you know, the coaching academy. That's how it happened. I mean, it was just natural outgrowth of all, it's all a natural outgrowth of 9/11. All right. But, you know, I decided to take a tragedy and turn it into something good. As I always tell people, you know what, 9/11 was a tragedy. But if we don't learn something from it, then it's twice the tragedy. So that's why I do what I do.
Well, I think you must be really quite an amazing person, Ari, because you hear that hopefulness in even as you were keeping your colleague going, you know, going down those stairs and always offering that hope. And we've just recently interviewed somebody in relation to hope. So it's on our minds at the moment, and how much of the time we spend talking about the role that hopelessness plays, but don't actively try and encourage the development of the installation of hope. So it's really, really lovely to hear about the work that you're doing. But I wondered, you know, what's motivational speaking added to your life? You know, what is it? How has that enriched your own sense of well-being?
Well, what I found out, you know how they say that man's biggest fears, two biggest fears are public speaking and death. And if you ever listen to Jerry Seinfeld, he said, if you're at a eulogy, you'd rather be in the box than delivering the eulogy. Because number one is public speaking. Now, I was blessed that I do not have that fear. God gave me a gift of speaking, all right, publicly. And the bigger the audience, the better I get. I remember it, you know, addressing 2,000 people in a room that was unbelievable. And I was just at the top of my game because it's just, you know, I don't fear that public speaking. So that was a gift that I was given, and I needed to make sure that I used it in the right way. And so I went ahead and I started motivating people. I just started telling my story and telling people, look, you know, I'm giving you a message of hope. All right. And I once went on a speaking tour in the UK, and a friend of mine had put the whole thing together. I spoke in 15 venues in a week. And when it was done, I turned to my friend. And I said, I want you to know something. I got more out of this week than any audience I spoke to. I was so motivated. All right. Because of, you know, what I was doing. And it was a tremendous, tremendous feeling. And I said, I never want to stop doing this. I always want to do this. And that's what I've been doing. You know, again, COVID came in and put the brakes on it, but we're coming out of it. I believe we're coming out of it. And I think, you know, I will have the opportunity again to address audiences around the world and give them hope and let them know that, you know what, you have greatness within you. You were born with greatness. You just have to let it out.
And just in case anyone missed it in the introduction, you're the author of Miracles and Fate on 78, which, you know, we've heard from that, you know, the really powerful story that you've shared with us today, how you know, how much you have to share from that day. But you're also involved with the not-for-profit organisation Strength to Strength. Can you tell us a bit about this organisation's work?
Oh, absolutely. This is an organization that was started by a woman by the name of Sari Singer. Sari was in Israel, in Jerusalem, on a bus when a suicide bomber got on the bus and blew himself up, and everybody around her were killed, and she was the only one that survived. And she was, you know, obviously she had suffered, you know, all kinds of injuries, but she fully recovered. And after she recovered, she decided that she wanted to take that experience and turn it into something good. And she started Strength to Strength, which is an organization that works with victims of terror around the world. She, you know, she touched base with me because she wanted me to be on the board. And I kept telling her, no, no, no. It took her about 2 years to finally convince me to get on the board. And I was very, very happy that I did, because they're amazing. The work that they do is absolutely amazing. They bring in, they have every year a young ambassadors trip where they bring kids between the ages of 14 and 21 who were victims of terror or who had family that were victims of terror. They bring them to New York, all expenses paid. They put them up for a week, all expenses paid, and they take them around New York, and they allow these kids to mingle with each other and tell their stories with each other to show, because very often a victim of terror in some way, shape, or form believes that it's their, you know, their responsibility. It's because of them that it happened. They were responsible for and it's not true. Obviously, we all know that. All right. It's not their fault that they're a victim of terror. And they're brought together to show that, you see, you're not the only one. There are so many others like you. You're a normal person, all right? Just had a bad experience. And it's changed the lives of terror victims. And so it's a wonderful, wonderful organization. Their website is stosglobal.org, stsglobal.org. If anybody wants to look into them, or, you know, they want to donate, they want to find out more about the organization, if they have friends or if they themselves are victims of terror, I urge them to reach out, because it's a tremendous organization.
Thank you. And what words of advice and wisdom do you have for those who might feel they've really reached a really low point in their lives? How might they find the hope that you managed to find in the midst of something very dark?
So my words of advice are this, okay? Nobody in this world is alone. They don't live alone. There are, you know, you walk out, you meet people. No matter where you go, you're people. This world is occupied by people. If you're spiraling down, you need to talk to somebody. You need to talk to somebody, preferably somebody who's gone through something and has come out of it. And, you know, I invite people all the time. If you have an issue, you have a problem, whatever it is, you can call me, you can email me, you can talk to me. I will be more than happy to talk with you and help you. All right. But nobody should be hopeless. Nobody should be hopeless. If you're hopeless, call me. All right. I'll get you out of it. We'll get, you know, and if I can't do it, I'll find somebody who can. All right. But never, never give up. Remember one thing. Every day above ground is a good day. Always remember that.
And great words to finish on, Ari. Ari, I feel so privileged that you came on the podcast to share your story. It was so powerful to hear your account. Thank you very much for being willing to do that with us.
Well, thank you for having me. And if anybody wants to find me, I'm all over social media, LinkedIn, Facebook, whatever. My email address is ari@arishombrun.com. So it's ari@arishombrun.com. I invite you to visit my podcast, whispersandbricks.com. And again, you know, you have my email, you find me on social media, you want to talk to me, not a problem. You want to find out more about my 7-week academy, not a problem. Again, I'm always here to help.
Thank you very much, Ari. That was really great. I mean, in many ways, it was a grueling conversation, but also pretty uplifting. So thanks a lot for that.
Thank you, David. I appreciate it. It was wonderful. Thank you so much for having me on your show. I wish you a lot of luck with your podcast. And Naomi, I had you on my podcast. Continue to keep doing what you're doing because you're doing great work.